from WXXI News. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Do you see that? Do you see that bag drifting in the wind? Is it making you think of life? And beauty? And cliche? Our connection this hour was made 20 years ago when DreamWorks Movie Studios asked us to look closer. The Oscar buzz was raging when the film American Beauty was released, starring Kevin Spacey and Annette Bening as America's most unhappy wealthy suburban couple. The film asked us to think about where we derive meaning. Do we obsess over expensive objects like couches and cars? Do we prioritize image, more interested in how the world sees us from the outside? Or do we find meaning in building real relationships? Those are good questions, vital questions in any society. For the creators of American Beauty, they found particular sore spots in suburban white America, where the kids are bored and the dads are sexually frustrated and the wives are nagging and superficial. And that's kind of the problem, for starters, with American Beauty. It didn't take long to see the stereotypes, the tired plot lines, before we even get to the question of pedophilia, homophobia, and more. Middle-aged man hits a midlife crisis, buys an expensive car, quits his job. Is that new? Is it profound? Well, at first, the critics said it was. American Beauty won the Oscar for Best Picture. Kevin Spacey won for Best Male Actor. It took in hundreds of millions of dollars to the worldwide box. But 20 years later, it's considered a mess. Huffington Post writes, quote, "This isn't a routine example of internet hot takes demanding retroactive wokeness, even if the movie raises questionable suggestions about pedophilia, queerness, and violence. Nor can we lay the about-face at Kevin Spacey's feet, even though the actor's numerous sexual assault allegations color how one might see his character's rapey proclivities," end quote. Premier Magazine listed American Beauty as one of the 20 most overrated American movies of all time, and Stephen Hayden, writing for UpRocks, says that American Beauty is the worst Best Picture winner of the modern era. This hour, we examine the reasons why a piece of art that was once celebrated is now widely mocked. We'll discuss the theme of critiquing suburban American life and the search for meaning, and we'll ask whether it's almost inevitable that social commentary of any era will age in a way that is quaint or worse. Our guests this hour include Vanessa Cheeks, organizer of the Anomaly Film Festival. Nice to see you. Welcome back.
Hey, thank you.
Also with us is Bree Merkel, artistic director for the Little Theater. Welcome to you.
Thanks for having me.
Scott Pukas is here, public relations coordinator for The Little and organizer of The Little's Party Like It's 1999 series, which does not include American Beauty.
It does not.
Not invited to the party. Welcome. Thanks for being here. Jack Fierick is a critic at large for PopDose.com and a former critic for Kirkus Reviews. Welcome back to you as well.
Always a pleasure.
So, you know, look, I'm sure there are some people listening going, wait a second, that movie was awesome. And I'm not going to try to sort of like rain on your parade if you remember it as a good film or if you like it or if you saw it recently and you still like it. Everybody likes different things. But this is an interesting film in that there is a real shift in how the critics – I mean, I'll start with the critic in the corner. I mean, the critics have not done well with this over the years, it seems.
No. It's the line on it has definitely changed. But there were people even at the time who saw it as being cliche and as superficial. The writing of the women's roles in particular is very thin. Annette Bening plays just a cartoon, you know, castrating a harpy of a wife who's holding poor Kevin Spacey back, you know, from fulfilling his dream of adopting the moral compass of a sociopath, essentially.
If not for her.
You know, he's let go from his job and basically decides that since acting like a responsible adult is not panning out for him personally, that he might as well just throw his moral compass to one side and live on impulse to make decisions as if he were a teenager again, which essentially translates into buying the sports car, you know.
And he's actually kind of the hero of the movie.
Oh, absolutely he is. I mean, and what does he do? You know, he's presented as a bold, brave truth teller because he won't keep his mouth shut. He gets buff, he jerks off, and he starts smoking dope, you know.
I think that's on the edge of what we're allowed to say.
Sorry. Okay. Megan having a heart attack behind the glass. Sorry about that. But And developing this erotic fixation on this friend of his daughter's, which is, and the movie tries to have it both ways. You know, I mean, yeah, it's kind of creepy and reprehensible that he's doing this, but my God, she's so hot. Oh my God, let's linger the camera over her naked body so we can all see how hot she is, and just, ooh, where was I? Oh yeah, really, really, just, yeah, no, he should never even think about that.
So you're saying from the start it should have been recognized as
hypocritical.
A mess.
Yeah, I mean, it's hypocritical is the worst thing about it.
Vanessa, you went back and watched it recently?
I watched it last night at midnight.
And how did it land with you now in 2019, 20 years later?
Yeah, it's interesting because the first time I watched it, I think I was like my early teens. And at the time, I don't think you necessarily recognize all those weird points. You're just like, oh, what's this weird, creepy dude? And you kind of identify with the teenage angst and stuff like that. But watching it as an adult at midnight, right up until about 2-something in the morning, because it's a very long movie, you start to see, like, these people are like this over hyper extension of what they're supposed to be. Like, the teens are angsty, but they're just this like ridiculous amount of angsty, and then the one's like borderline, like you think he's going to kill somebody until she's like, no, I'm just kidding, and he's like, yeah, sure, kidding. And so it was weird to me to see like Kevin Spacey in this role now after his trial and everything like that, and also just to see, I guess, what I thought I would identify with, and now looking back as an adult, like, wait, I was never like that. Like, I never said lame-o, I think, a day in my life.
Bad dialogue.
Yeah, the worst dialogue. I don't think, you know, with my girlfriends we ever, like, behaved that way or spoke that way. So I think it was just, like, the writing just didn't really hit what actual people did, what normal people, what people behaved like. So, yeah.
And Scott Pukas, I mean, it turns out that Kevin Spacey was playing himself in that. And so you've decided that it doesn't really fit in the little lineup this year?
Yeah, it just seemed kind of gross to me to do that for a number of reasons. In 1999, if anyone out there is listening, if you Google it, there's so many good movies out there that you don't necessarily need to revisit this one again. And that was one of the main reasons that, you know, I didn't want to show it was the Kevin Spacey. Him playing that role in that movie just seemed not right. The mostly white cast, too, you know, that kind of rubbed me the wrong way as well. And even it was a movie that I liked when I first saw it, and then revisiting it, the dialogue doesn't seem as clever as it once did.
No.
And Alan Ball is a great writer. He wrote 6 Feet Under, which that has really well-developed characters and really good writing. So it makes it a little bit of a disappointment that the writing here is not quite as good as you'd want it.
Yeah, I mean, there's a number I wouldn't be the first to point out the writing, and there's a number of sites that have sort of cataloged the worst of the lines, but yeah, I'm not really sure how that script reflects on Ball, who, you're right, has a resume of being sort of better than that. Bree, how does the film hold up to you?
Well, okay, so I did mention that I do still think that, I watched it yesterday, I do still think that the cinematography in the film is amazing. Conrad Hall, it was wonderful. It doesn't hold up great. And I have a weird theory, okay, if you'll indulge me for a second. My theory is that, you know, this came out in 1999. That's when baby boomers are starting to maybe have their midlife crises, right? They're the largest generation at that time ever. They can relate to that part of it. And then you had me, child of baby boomer, who was in my angsty teens, relating on a totally different level. So I think that this movie is just really emotionally manipulative and worked for two very large sections of the population at large at that time when it came out in different ways.
Did you ever say the word lame-o to your friends?
No. No. The dialogue is bad. The dialogue is very bad. It does not hold up at all. Yeah. And that whole, the school scene is not well thought out in so many ways. I mean, the only other classmates they talk to look like they're like 35 years old and housewife, you know. It just seems like it was thrown in, and all of a sudden someone was like, oh my God, we need someone to play a classmate opposite them and just grab somebody.
Hello, you know? Young people.
Greetings, fellow kids.
Exactly.
Hello, kids. but let me also kind of key in on something that I do think, going back and watching it as I watched it last night, very late, probably at the same time Vanessa was watching it, which is that I'm going to disagree with some of the modern rethinking of American Beauty, in that some of the critics now say that movie is like frozen in time, 1999. I don't think so. There's a lot of empty, upper middle class white suburban life going on in this country, even still. There's a lot of people sort of trying to keep up with the Joneses and who want to buy that. There's this, actually one of the only really good scenes, I think, is when Kevin Spacey is sort of trying to, his character is kind of trying to be amorous again with Annette Bening, his wife, in the movie, and they're in their living room, and she's worried that if they start making out, she's going to spill beer on their $4,000 couch. And he's going, it's just a thing. Who cares what the couch is? You're more worried about the couch than living. And I actually thought, okay, that's not the first time someone's made this commentary on the emptiness of suburban life, but I don't think that's frozen in 1999. I think we're still a society that struggles with meaning. I think we struggle with, you know, where do you derive meaning from? Where do you get it from? Do you care about image, how people see you? So I think that's valuable. Do you at least agree that something could have been interesting said about those things?
Yeah, and I think a lot of critics at the time viewed it as pure satire, right? I mean, I was just reading a bunch of different old reviews of the film, and some people felt like it was, when I say completely satire, like none of that was supposed to actually be, you know, like it's all just a commentary. So in that way, if you look at it overall, yeah, those are kind of timeless questions, right? I mean, what year did Lolita come out? I mean, that's not a new, you know, trope, but I think the problem is in the writing and is in the, you know, is there's all these little things that just make the film not hold water. And, you know, there's also, I don't know if that movie would have won Best Picture if Shakespeare in Love didn't win Best Picture the year before. Like, there's things you can start to get into about that too, if you care about the Oscars and things like that and why it won Best Picture, you know. So it was kind of riding on this, you know, quote unquote indie wave, which is a whole other argument, because this film had a $15 million budget. Shakespeare in Love had a $25 million budget. Both of them were considered indie films, and people were actually coming out to watch indie films, you know. But are they really?
all the actual indie filmmakers listening right now are like, I would like that budget.
Exactly.
That would be fine. Scott, how do you feel about what the film is at least trying to say, which I think we ought to always welcome art that challenges us to ask where we derive meaning from and where we derive value from. At the very least, I think that's a valid question.
Yeah, I don't think there was anything wrong with what it was trying to say. And that's one of the scenes that gets mocked the most, with the plastic bag floating around. And he's like, there's beauty in everything. You know, the satire there is pretty obvious. But I think one of the problems is there was better satire as that movie in 1999. There was Fight Club, Office Space, Election, which we talked about a little before the show, which I think came out around the same time, and they're better satires. And it's funny, all those movies, especially Fight Club and Office Space, bombed at the box office. They did not do well, whereas American Beauty won Best Picture. But later, mostly thanks to DVDs, Office Space and Fight Club got a huge following, and now they're considered to be classics.
Office Space is a way better commentary on cubicle life. The Kevin Spacey stuff, and on the subject of that beauty and the bag blown in the wind, if you haven't seen the film, the next door neighbor, the newly moved in family, has a son who has a fetish for sure with the camera, to the point of being like, it would probably never be okay shooting in people's windows all the time until he's told to stop, and then the next night shooting in the window again, even though he's been told to stop, and then somehow that works out for him. But there's a scene, and this is Stephen Hyden writing for UpRocks, who says, there's so much beauty in the world, it makes my heart burst, the character says about that plastic bag, and it rings about as true as everything else in this movie. No character or plot development in American Beauty has any recognizable tie to how people actually talk or behave in the real world. Earlier in the film, Ricky marvels at the beauty of finding a dead homeless woman in the street. When you see something like that, it's like God is looking right at you just for a second, he says. And if you're careful, you can look right back. He's talking about a dead homeless woman, end quote. So maybe a little trying too hard on the whole beauty thing and not realizing privilege you know, just totally blind to privilege.
They're just pretentious, too.
Pretentious, yeah. But Vanessa, are there any themes there that you go, okay, at least this is a valuable theme that could have been done better in this film?
honestly, not really. I think that whole idea of, like, looking closer, when I looked at this film...
You didn't see anything.
I didn't see anything. And there were so many points where I, you're right, I think I was, like, watching it and staring at it, like, maybe this time, maybe this is it. And then they would go into some pretentious dialogue about the beauty, and he was, like, crying. And I'm like, it's a bag. So I just... Every time I think it got close, it did lose it with the dialogue and I think the only saving grace is that it's so beautifully shot, because there were I just watched it at that point to watch it, to look at it, and to marvel in just how beautifully done it was. And just, like, everybody, when you do look closer at the characters, you see, like, they are just as terrible as they are face forward. You see how they interact with each other and how they act by themselves, and it's just like, oh, you're just even worse when you're alone. You're just even more terrible. And so, yeah, no, I don't think at all it has any saving grace.
And I also think, to Jack's point, Annette Bening was given nothing to work with there.
Yeah.
She's like the villain in the family, and look, everybody in that family has their own issues to deal with, but he is given some kind of a hero treatment while she is viewed as this, you know, shallow,
yeah,
nagging, all the worst stereotypes to me.
Which, you're right, I do still see a lot of those stereotypes today in media and film and stuff like that, and it is exhausting, and she is, like, the worst at poor Annette Bening. But, like, I wish that she, I don't know. I guess I kind of do identify with her at this point, because as somebody who, like, I think my career is important, et cetera, et cetera. But at the same time, yeah, they're all terrible. They're all the worst.
I do want someone to call us and listen, push back. This panel is wrong, audience, and you're going to tell them at 844-295-TALK. We're talking American Beauty, 844-295-8255. 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. You can email the program connections@WXXI.org. But Jack, if a film wants to make a commentary about what our values are, about the way we sort of get busted as we think about image and projecting something to the world, even if there wasn't anything particularly new here, I think it's valuable to re-examine that. Could this have been done better? Is this a film that shouldn't have been made? Are there more interesting films that have a commentary on sort of our hollow values and image?
Absolutely, it could have been made better. And it's the point that keeps coming up is pretentiousness. And actually, in this case, I think that the beautiful production values on the film, and it is, it's beautifully shot, it's beautifully scored, but that almost works against it if it's supposed to be a satire, because we're seeing Kevin Spacey through this, you know, unabashedly heroic sort of lens, just in the way that he's shot, in the way that the camera regards him, and in that god-awful solemn piano music, you know? I mean, really telling you, no, this is deep. This is really deep. But no, there are absolutely better films about, you know, similar situations, about midlife crises and dealing with, you know, with the loss of employment. There was a film from about the same time period, I would have to check the year, as a French movie. The title translates as Time Out, and it's about a guy who has a very solid middle-class lifestyle. Good job. He's let go. He can't bear to tell his family, you know? And so for weeks, he... oh, my God, you people hate me, don't you? So for weeks, he pretends that he still has his job. He leaves the house every day. He comes back every evening. And, you know, the savings are slowly, slowly dwindling. And it's a fascinating movie. And it plays like a horror movie. I think it's one of the most scary movies that I've ever seen. But
that's the good version
of it. That's the good version of it.
Can we stop for a second and just take this in? Feel this.
Rose petal in my coffee mug.
Jack says that's insufferable.
yep.
And the film you're talking about, producer Megan Mack tells me, is L'Emploi du Temps.
L'Emploi du Temps, yes.
Okay, so that's one to seek out.
Yeah, I think so.
Are you saying yes there, Brie?
Yes, and also, but last night I was thinking of the movie The Ice Storm, which came out 2 years before this, and I feel like also explores some of the same issues and probably does... a better job.
And right, and deals with it simultaneously with those issues among a set of adult characters and among a set of teenage characters.
Yeah.
And it is a much better film. Yeah.
Well, let me try to get our first counterpoint. And this is Rob in Rochester on the phone first. Go ahead, Rob.
Evan, thank you for taking the call. And I confess first, I've only listened about the last 15 or 20 of your conversation. I got in the car. And I have seen the movie once since it came out. In other words, I've seen it twice, but I have not had a fresh view of the movie. But I felt listening to you guys I had a very different point of view,
okay.
And I was surprised that at least in the 20 minutes I caught you seemed to not feel the movie held up. But what I thought one of the panelists had mentioned the movie being, you know, either satire or even more commentary. And even some of the, and I would agree with that. I think even some of the things that some of you of the panelists didn't like about it, like the, you know, some of the characters were older than they seemed, and or the pretentiousness of the neighbor in his filming of that plastic bag, and even the stiltedness of some of the characters, that all to me felt like one large piece of a commentary on the emptiness of maybe American beauty, of what at that moment in our culture, which I don't know that it's changed much, was a kind of emptiness, the kind of shallowness, even in, you know, the sexual interests of the characters. And so to me, I remember having a profound feeling when I watched the film. It wasn't necessarily a good feeling, but it evoked strong feelings and made me think a lot about not only myself, but I mean about the culture. So I personally didn't find any of those, whatever you want to call them, techniques or choices by the writers to be false, other than they served the larger purpose. I thought it was sort of a satire or a kick in the stomach about America and what it understood to be beauty or materialism. And to me, on the emotional level, I thought it worked very, very well. And I also did like Fight Club. I didn't know it was the same year, which I do think, as one of your panelists said, was had similar themes. And I thought that was great. But I think American Beauty evoked stronger feelings and images for me. So to me, it stands. So that's just thought I'd give that as a counterpoint.
I'm glad you called, Rob. Thank you. Hey, thank you very much for that. And
sure.
So Rob's point is it impacted him in a way that was pretty strong. I think some of what we got to be careful here, and I'm not criticizing Rob. I'm just sort of, because I would probably do this myself here, is when we talk about what it said about America, that's a pretty limited slice of America, mm-hmm. you know?
Yeah.
America, where there's more poverty, America, communities of color, they probably feel very differently about what it means to be about America when it's about suburban, upper middle class, white America. But to Rob's point, it made him reevaluate or think about what we value, how thin that might be. And at the very least, you know, he could overlook some of the film's faults to say, you're trying to get us to look in the mirror a little bit. Jack, you moved.
I mean, I will not deny the validity of the themes, okay? But a theme is not a statement. A theme is a question. And the answers that this particular film offered to those questions, I think, didn't hold up. I think that if it was meant to be satire, it worked against itself. It played it too straight. It seemed to buy too uncritically into Kevin Spacey's transformation, Lester's transformation. We really shouldn't conflate the act with the character. But it was a little too – it burnished his halo a little too much. It kind of seemed to endorse his choices, or at the very least to try to have it both ways, particularly in – his treatment of the Mina Suvari character.
Okay, but let me just kind of try to push in one way here too. You're someone who has occasionally been critical of capitalism.
Yeah.
Fair?
Occasionally.
Okay. So the scene where Kevin Spacey quits work and he's going to be laid off, you're right.
Right.
But then he blackmails work because he's got information on the boss. And again, the most cliche way, but he's got the information and he gets them to commit to a full year salary and benefits so he doesn't release the information. And he's walking out of work with his briefcase and his stuff in his hand. He's looking at all the other, what he would call the minions there, and he's pumping his fist like, I'm out of there. That loser company, ha, suckers. And is there a kind of anti-capitalist commentary that you can get behind there?
It's a catharsis for anybody living in a capitalist system, but it's certainly not, it doesn't work, I think, as an overall commentary on capitalism because it's not scalable.
It's not scalable, and, you know, things were on the way to actually working out for him. He gets his year pay, he Absolutely. Takes a little side job, he's having fun, he buys a car, he has this, you know, this growth at the end where if he doesn't get shot in the head, he's going to have it all figured out. So you're saying if it's an anti-capitalist take, it's way too pat?
Yeah.
Okay. Okay.
That's fair.
I'm trying, Jack. That's I'm trying fair. To get you to like this movie.
I appreciate it, Evan.
Not happening. It's not happening for Jack Ferrick. But, well, no, I thought Kent was going to help with me, but no, Kent's going to agree with the panel. Go ahead, Kent.
Hey, Evan, I know you were looking for dissent. I'm sorry.
No, that's okay. Bring it.
I have to say, I mean, the big thing that the panel's already touched on, and I just have to echo 100%, it doesn't matter what they wanted to set out with this film and the beautiful shots that they've got and the piano theme that House basically lifted for two-thirds of its runs. The dialogue in that film and the characters that are written are so one-dimensional, so absurdly unrealistic. You could never communicate anything. It's like reading bad fan fiction that was written by someone who has no appreciation for the concept of an organic character that is their own person. It's just the writer cramming what he wants to say to sound poetic and deep down your throat. And it is so ham-fisted, there is no salvation for it.
Yes, let the hate flow through you, Kent.
Yeah, we're going full fifth today.
Full fifth. Kent's getting a standing ovation from the panel here. Nothing redeeming. Well, Kent, I appreciate the data point there. We're talking about 20 years since the release of American Beauty, which won the Oscar for Best Picture, but is now viewed as one of the worst Best Picture films, at least of the modern era. Here is Wayne, who says, I most appreciated the Spacey character's situation of how he sees the change in his life, the feeling of frustration with his life going nowhere, his marriage failing, and his daughter losing respect for him. It is a one-sided representation, but that is okay. Vanessa, is it okay?
It's not okay. What I would draw a parallel, and I saw this in an article I read about it as well, is that like Tony Soprano also had those same issues, and he just killed people left and right, and I feel like Kevin Spacey was so close to that. Maybe Annette Bening first, because she totally had the gun. I feel like if Wes's dad didn't kill him
first. The Kevin Spacey character.
Yes, yeah. Bennett would have definitely done it. But yeah, what was the question?
Well, he's essentially saying, yes, it was a one-sided portrayal, but here's a guy who was frustrated with all the things that were going against him. Do you have any sympathy for that kind of a character?
No, for Lester, I think when I, you know, rewatching it and kind of having blanked out the actual movie, yes, you watch it in the beginning and you're like, oh, he's unhappy in his marriage and he's frustrated because his kid and his wife obviously hate his guts and he's wearing an ill-fitting suit and his job is terrible. But then, like, that scene where he is first introduced to his daughter's friend, that's when you're like, oh, this isn't a good guy. This isn't a redeemable guy. And his entire interactions with her moving forward, his interactions with his daughter, his interactions with his wife, it just kind of goes to show that he's not a hero, no matter how the, you know, whatever rose-colored glasses, pun intended, are put over this film and his character. I personally don't think anybody is redeemable in that film except for Allison Janney, because she is a national treasure.
And sort of wasted here. I mean,
wasted. Oh, I know. Yeah. I saw her. I was like, oh, my God.
She was a kind of comatose character. Jackie writes to say, I saw this film premiere at the Toronto Film Festival. I remember being creeped out by Kevin Spacey and frustrated by the treatment of Annette Bening's character. I was floored at the end of the movie when Kevin Spacey took Q&A from a doting audience and got a standing ovation at the end of the film. At the time, I attributed it to his own personal coolness and appeal at the time, which even more frustrated me, and now in retrospect, it infuriates me. You know, Brie, I've never been in a situation like that where I'm at the film and they're there. I mean, is there like a feeling of like the audience is excited, so there's going to be a standing, or do you think, why are we applauding that character, that person?
there's, yeah, I mean, if you're talking about a film festival setting, I've definitely seen a few questionable standing ovations. And I think there's something, there's a reason why it's called a festival. Everyone's in a good mood generally, you know, you're, but there is a little bit of kissing up that happens at a festival, in a festival audience. And there are a lot of people that worked on that movie in an audience usually. So you can't really go by something like that to decide. I mean, maybe you can in France where they routinely boo people at Cannes all the time, which I would love to see. But at Toronto, I don't know. But yeah, I mean, no, Kevin Spacey did not, even at that time, he did not deserve a glowing reception for that, for his film.
Is it a little creepy in retrospect, or should it have been creepy at the time that the audience was cheering for that Lester Burnham character, not the Kevin Spacey actor? Maybe they're cheering for him. I don't know. Do you give the audience a pass there?
Yeah, I mean, I can see why they did cheer. I mean, he won the Oscar for Best Picture, too. I mean, it was universally agreed upon that he was good. I mean, it should have been creepy, but I think it, part of it, it was intentionally creepy, too. I mean, you could argue that that was part of it. It was meant to be creepy, and he's just acting. But now looking back at it, knowing that he may actually have those tendencies, it becomes a little problematic.
As we take our only break of the hour, I want our listeners to know, again, if you want to keep coming at us with the pro-American beauty takes, we're going to take them from you at 844-295-TALK, or you can email connections@wxxi.org. After our only break of the hour, we're going to talk about, you know, when we have cultural and social commentary, maybe the better versions of that, or if it's precarious, if it's likely that it's going to be mocked in the future because culture changes. I will offer this, though. The interesting thing for me, not as a critic, but as someone who thought, you know, before Kevin Spacey died, that he was a pretty good actor, is that he didn't die with his career. But that he was in a film called The Ref in the mid-90s, which is also a film about a breakdown of a suburban couple with a nice house. But it's actually more interesting for me than American Beauty was. So Kevin Spacey played the husband in a frustrated, going nowhere, upper class marriage in a different movie. But then he did American Beauty. That's what we're talking about with our guests, and we'll reintroduce you to them when we come back. I'm Evan Dawson. Tuesday on The Next Connections, we talk with actor Sean Astin, the star of The Goonies, Rudy, and Lord of the Rings, is coming to Rochester as a guest of East House to talk about how to reduce the stigma of mental illness. His mother was Patty Duke. Then in our second hour, it's all things cider. We preview the Finger Lakes Cider Week, which kicks off on the 27th. Talk with you on Tuesday. Now I got to go back and watch The Ref again to see if it holds up, and I will probably be awakened to my own badness as a critic, of which I am not. But I will go back and watch The Ref again because I remember liking it, and I think I liked it better than American Beauty as a commentary on America's busted upper middle class white suburbs. We'll see. You can join the program if you like. Connections@wxxi.org. It was 20 years ago that American Beauty came out. Critical acclaim, big worldwide box office of more than $350 million, and the Oscar for Best Picture. Now, the Little Theater is doing a series called Party Like It's 1999. You're not going to see American Beauty as part of the series for reasons Scott's already explained. But tell us just briefly what you are doing with Party Like It's 1999.
Yeah, so this was inspired by, I read this book. It's called Best Movie Year Ever, How 1999 Blew Up the Big Screen. It's at the library in Monroe County. It's a great read. It's by Brian Rafferty. And it talks about all the great movies of 1999. And they weren't just good movies. They were original ideas. They weren't sequels. They were stuff that bombed at the box office, innovative ideas. We'd mentioned Office Space is a good satire. That's the next one we're screening in the series, which is 1 week from today, Monday, September 23rd at 6:30. It's on our $5 Movie Monday, too, so it's only $5, which is nice. So we're screening that. We have Iron Giant coming up in October, Blair Witch Project. So 1999 truly was, I think, my favorite movie year. So it's nice to revisit some of these. And American Beauty just did not make the cut.
I wonder if Blair Witch holds up, by the way, because that movie actually scared me. And I was an adult human at the time.
It does. I think it
holds up.
I saw it with an audience this past year, and everyone was freaking out.
I'm telling you, you know exactly what it's about. And you're like, this is ridiculous. And you go in there and you're like, okay, I'm scared. I don't know why this is working for me. Nancy in Rochester, though, here we go. Call to arms for the pushing back crowd. Nancy is going to tell us why everyone's wrong. Go ahead, Nancy.
I don't know about that, but I absolutely love the film, and I'm horrified by, you know, critics sitting around being snitty and pontificating, because there was one section in it where the drug dealing boyfriend shows one of his films. It's a plastic bag before floating in the air.
Yeah.
Before a snowstorm, and I absolutely love it. I've used it as a personal mantra. I've said like did I have 50 minutes of beauty a day? I talk to students about it. Yeah, there are creepy sections, but I also just love the Annie Lennox song. So anyway, I thought it was a really good film. And one last question: so did Alan Ball write it?
He did.
Yes,
he
did. See, now I was madly in love with Six Feet Under, and I loved everything about Alan Ball. But thank you very much.
Hey, Nancy, can I ask you a question?
Yeah, go ahead.
Because you're obviously familiar with the writer, Alan Ball, who's gay, by the way. And some of the criticism now is that the treatment of homosexuality in American Beauty was heavy-handed. And I'm going to read one critic's exploration of that, talking about gayness as a fatal revelation. Quote, Ball and Mendez were attempting to criticize the materialistic facades that upper-class Americans adopt to preserve manicured reputations. But their ideas about overcoming pedophilia are reductive, and their treatment of gayness as a fatal revelation underlines how much American Beauty is a product of its time, not timeless. And what they're talking about, for people who don't know, didn't see the film, is that the next-door neighbor is a former Marine who actually has Nazi proclivities, is physically violent with his son, tells his son that he doesn't want his son to grow up and be gay, that would be the worst thing. And it turns out that he is a closeted gay man himself, and he basically becomes murderous at the end of having to confront that. And they're criticizing that. Did that bother you at all, Nancy?
No. I mean, I love Boys in the Band, and I know that a lot of people who see that film, I mean, they might have a lot of problems with it. But isn't that true today? I mean, there are so repressed gays who want to kill somebody because of the way they feel. So, I mean, it's not the greatest work of art, but I mean, I wouldn't feel that it was, that was reducing the homosexuality or how, you know, with that one character. But no, I mean, doesn't it still happen today?
Yeah, I'm with you. Nancy, thanks for the phone call. I really appreciate that. And I'm actually with Nancy on this one here. I disagree with the critic who I just read, because in this case, I do think the film is, you know, it's a product of its time in certain ways, but it's a pro-gay film. I mean, it was written, I think Ball was making points about, there's a gay couple, Jim and Jim, who live nearby, and the Nazi in the neighborhood doesn't like them and is complaining about them. And his son is like, yeah, well, you know, basically just taking up for them. Well, maybe they're just living a life like anybody else out here, which at the time was something the country was still struggling with and probably still does. So I don't know. I was okay with that. How does everybody?
It's not like heterosexuality gets off easy either.
Yeah, that's true. You know? Yeah, I mean, I think that I don't know. I actually think that that's one of the parts of the film that really works for me. I think that, what's his last name? The actor
Cooper.
Chris thank Cooper. You, Chris Cooper, does a really good job in that role, and I think that. There was a lot of dimension to that pain that he was suffering and how it radiated out in his family. Like we were saying with Allison Janney, and she's not given anything to work with, but she, if you're talking about it as a satire, she's like this empty shell of a person for having to deal with the amount of like self-hatred that husband was just projecting out. You know, Ricky knows exactly what to say for the most part to keep him from at bay, because he just seems to want to beat him to death all the time, you know? So, and he flips immediately in the car when, you know, at first he tries to defend Jim and Jim, and then, you know, his dad says something about it, and immediately he goes back to, oh no, they make me sick, you know? And I thought that Alan Ball also, it was interesting because to me, knowing what I do about him, I think there was sort of a nod to stereotypes of gay people in that film, too. Like the way that, you know, the father just thinks that because in his mind, Kevin Spacey's character is gay, he could just walk up and try to kiss him. Like, that would be fine because, you know, aren't all gay people just waiting to kiss other gay people? You know, I mean, I think that they act, that was maybe the most dimensional, and maybe that had to do with Alan Ball, to me. You know?
Vanessa, you watched it last night. Any issues with the treatment of the gay storylines there?
No, and I think, that is the most fleshed out part, even though it is like a I don't want to say a small section of it, but it doesn't have as much screen time, I guess you would say. And they do fall into these stereotypes. They're super fit. They're super friendly. They talk to everybody and they're just trying to like get along. And then there is this underlying, you know, hatred for them. And it doesn't, it seems like all the drama though, like doesn't seem to touch them. And it kind of leaves Jim and Jim, thank God, to their own devices.
Yeah.
But no, I didn't see any like real big problem with that. And I thought it was handled pretty well. So,
well, here's Linda in Penfield emailing the show to say, whenever I think of American Beauty, I think this is the last Best Picture winner before 9/11. And I think, oh, we were so innocent then to ponder plastic bags and husbands chasing underage girls. I think movies since then have been under the seismic shadow of 9/11. Any comments? Welcome. Jack, yes or no?
It's a theory.
It doesn't sound like you're on board with that.
Maybe not. It's not something that I've considered. I'd have to think about it more. But it's possible. I mean, it's a very inward-looking movie. It's very much looking inward at America, and it's you know, our relationship with each other and our relationship to the society in which we live. It doesn't look outwards, and for better or worse, 9/11 reminded us all that we live in a much larger world. So that even films that focus on America tend to be a little more inclusive and more about reaching across to different kinds of people in America. I just want to get back to something that you said about how American Beauty is regarded as being the most embarrassing Best Picture winner of modern times. I'm actually surprised by that because Crash, which was directed by Paul Haggis from 2004, again, that was one that critical consensus seems to have very much turned on a dime, particularly because of its treatment of racial themes, you know, the themes of people of different races and how we see each other and how we stereotype each other, but also, you know, the where it falls down is its privileging of the white perspective in that. But again, though, that at least is a film about trying to make connections between different kinds of people from different experiences. It's not, you know, so much infighting in the way that American Beauty is, where you've got this small slice of the socioeconomic spectrum here in America, and it's all about troubles within that slice. So
that a lot of people would probably roll their eyes at.
A little bit, yeah, because there are people with real problems in this world.
Yeah, yeah. So I want to talk just a little bit about when there are pieces of art, films among them, that try to make commentary about culture in a moment, because culture evolves. You know, what is sort of norms and expectations evolve over time. Is it always going to flop like that, Jack? Because you don't think so. You think that you can make cultural statements that maybe there will be elements of it that are viewed as of a time, but they aren't going to be always mocked or lampooned.
Oh, yeah. No, absolutely. And I think that a lot of what we see as being sort of a reversal of the critical line is simply that there are voices in the discourse now that haven't always been heard. I mean, the critical industry, for lack of a better term, still has a diversity problem. It's still overwhelmingly white. It's still overwhelmingly male. And, you know, I mean, going back to a movie like Birth of a Nation, you know, back in the 19-teens, for a long time, the critical line on that was, well, you know, yes, there's grotesque racism in it, but it's of real technical importance, so it's still artistically worthwhile. And that argument has gradually diminished to the point where it's basically regarded now as, yeah, no, this is a bad film made for bad purposes by a bad person, and it's of historical value only. But the thing is, those voices were always there, calling that film out, but they were being published in, you know, in black newspapers and in socialist magazines. They were not part of the mainstream critical discourse. Compare that, even the critical reception of something like Crash, which took a couple of years for, you know, the mainstream opinion to kind of sour on, compare that with something like Three Billboards Outside Ebbing, Missouri, which mm-hmm. came out last year. And early audiences, mostly film critics who saw it at festivals, were really ecstatic over it. But even before it started rolling into general release, you had critics of color saying, well, no, there's this really, the film privileges this unearned redemption narrative for this savagely racist cop, and, you know, there's all kinds of problematic elements to it. And it seemed like the critical consensus turned on a dime. But really what it was is it was just more people were getting to see it. And thanks to social media, more people have a voice in the critical discourse. So the power of the big critics to shape the consensus opinion is diminishing. There's simply more people getting involved in the conversation now, and that's a good thing.
Brie, are you feeling like people can still make films that will hold up even if they have a lot to say on the culture?
Yeah, I mean, I also feel like what's wrong with a film being kind of a time capsule? You know, I think that is fine, and we're more talking about the film critically, but as a time capsule, if you're looking at it that way, I don't know that it's really that offensive in 1999. But going back to what you started by saying, I would hope that most films seem a little bit outdated and problematic 20 years from the point. That means that we're getting somewhere, right? Like, to me,
yeah.
I don't know. I would like to see things changing, and then I'd like to look back at what happened 20 years ago and see maybe the ways that things have improved.
How do you feel about that, Vanessa?
I agree. I mean, I think it's interesting now to see people, whenever we do have that conversation on like Twitter or social media about a film, whether it's new or old, there's always a group of people who are like, don't criticize it. You shouldn't, you know, just let people enjoy things. But you can criticize things and completely enjoy them. There are movies that I watch and I'm like, oh, this is extremely problematic, but I still want to watch them. I still, you know, there are still elements in it that I enjoy. American Beauty is not one of those things, but some people do like it and enjoy the film. But I think there is a strength in being able to pick out things and identify things that are not okay or that could use work or could have been done better, because being able to talk about those things and publish them or even just tweet about it, then whoever is going to make the next film is going to be able to do better, to have a platform to say, okay, you know, I can make these characters better, improve on the script, improve on the dialogue, exclude lame-o completely, 100%. People don't talk like that. But yeah, we shouldn't be afraid to just take these things, whether they're new or old, to task. And because I feel like now, too, also that's part of the enjoyment, being able to criticize things. That there's nothing better than like live tweeting something with a group of people and like criticizing it in real time and just dissecting it in real time. But again, you still enjoy it, and that's still part of a new experience you can have with it.
When's the next Party Like It's 1999 series?
So it's coming up a week from today. It's Office Space, 6:30 on September 23rd. Iron Giant, October 5th. Blair Witch Project, October 30th, day before Halloween. And then Election, November 11th.
Yeah. Nice. One of these days we're going to have a show on Office Space. And if cubicle culture is still that, I love that. Adam Lubitar, a friend who writes for City, of course, who couldn't be here on the panel today, did not love American Beauty, but he says, more love for The Ref, an underrated Christmas movie, too. Yes, Adam, thank you. And I want to read an email from Tim, who says, as a poor African-American young man growing up, this film, he's talking about American Beauty, quickly became an escape from day-to-day hardships of life for me. And when I saw American Beauty, I felt that the shallow emptiness of it was exactly what I had experienced in my limited exposure to suburban life. The few white friends I had at the time all had new cars at age 16. There were TVs left on in every room of their homes. Meanwhile, I didn't know if I'd have anything to eat that night when I got home. I thought this movie was how all people with money and privilege behaved. Self-indulgence just seemed to naturally fit. Yes, the movie is bad, but was it far from the truth? It's from Tim.
I mean, there is this like reoccurring joke within the black community about how like we would talk to our parents versus our white friends talking to our parents. And I did see that in American Beauty, where she just like got up from the dinner table and like called her dad lame and like, I don't know. Her attitude is like, oh, I would never have gotten away with that in my life. Like,
so the response maybe that is That's a white thing to be able to get away with that?
Oh, the whole movie was a white thing. Like, start to finish. I think, like you mentioned it earlier, people have there are real problems out there. And I think, you know, this being this carved out slice of America where it is like upper class, you know, rich white people doing rich white people things. There is that whole other segment where they're just like, okay, you're filming a bag. Could you pick it up? Could you throw it away? Like it, like the turtles are dying. Like, what are you doing? What are you doing? And then he's like upset, you know, I want to trade in my car and like buy a new car. Okay, well, what about the car payment? Yeah. And what, like, who does that? Who just goes out and gets a new car? Also, does it snow there? I don't know where they lived, but that didn't seem like an economically viable option.
We need to do Mystery Science Theater. Yeah, like, oh my gosh.
I want Vanessa to live tweet everything.
Listen, my friends at Anomaly know that I have rants and about any film, but like it just,
I like you.
There are just elements to it where, yeah, it is like start to finish, you're just like, I think he's right, you know, Tim is right, it is an escape, because for some communities this is just like utter nonsense, because nobody would do that, or at least like, yeah, other people wouldn't do that. I don't know how y'all interact, but
well, as we close here, give me one film from 99 that either should have won Best Picture or everybody should see if they haven't seen.
Being John Malkovich.
Being John Malkovich.
I don't know. I was young in 1999.
Yeah.
That's why we're doing the series.
I know, but I can't.
Jack.
The first Matrix movie.
What?
The first Matrix movie.
I'm sorry.
The Matrix. Sorry.
That's a movie.
Keanu Reeves. It's his year.
You know what? I do love Keanu Reeves. Go ahead.
Jack's gonna red pill you. Oh, is it blue? It's a red pill. It's red pill. That's the
yeah, red.
Okay.
Red pill means something different.
I know it does now. Yes, it does.
We're also playing it for the 99 series, but Boys Don't Cry.
Oh.
Yeah, that's a great, great movie. But also interested to see how it holds up 20 years later. Mm. I have not watched it since it came out.
I want to thank all of our guests who remind us that, boy, there's just beauty everywhere. Looking outside the window now. I see a flag blowing, but somewhere behind the flag in the distance is probably a plastic bag. And now, 20 years after American Beauty, it's been banned. What does it mean to be banned, anyway? Should we pay a fee for that plastic bag? Should we pay a fee for beauty? Anyway, Emma Rae Stein is the intern. Megan Mack is the producer. Bob is the volunteer. Rob is the engineer. I'm Evan.